What was it like growing up in Cleveland?
It was great. I mean, you have no, you're insulated from the rest of the world, right? So there's no, I don't know what it was like to grow up in New York City or out in California or anything, nor did I care. I was happy in my bubble. So, I mean, I'm pretty sure that's a pretty typical thing when you're growing up. Like, you just have no idea. But mm-hmm. yeah, I mean, growing up in Cleveland was sick. We got four seasons. Had a bunch of family and friends all there. So I think nothing but good memories.
Nothing but good
lots memories. Of nostalgia. Yeah.
Did you start any companies when you were a kid or work on any projects?
Yeah. Yes. I think one of the first weird things I did was I tried to, I'm gonna butcher this, but I think I put a bunch of my friends to work and we created a like secret language to encode like all of our comms basically. But the idea of this business was basically going around and like foraging stuff that we could find like in the neighborhood. So if you found a bike or like a skateboard or something like that, we would collectively like try to find weird stuff like that and then sell it to people. But we had like our own communication system that was like totally encoded.
How did you guys come up with that?
This just came out of my brain. It was super weird. I have no idea.
Okay.
I might actually have some of the sketches and drawings from that. But even, yeah, like even from a really early age when I was like, I don't know, before I was even 10, I think I found the concept of money to be just like really bizarre. And even with like my immediate siblings and family members, I remember being in like our backyard and thinking that like, why don't we just use leaves for money? So I'd collect all of like most pristine leaves I could find and be like, these are the best ones. This is now our currency. And I would use, I'd use these, I think they came from like beech trees and they looked, you know, they're like really cool looking. But I was like, let's just use this for money. Like why, I don't need like a dollar for chores. Like I'll just use 10 leaves. And there's other ones as well.
Now yeah, that no, you're making me think about this. Let's go into them.
I mean, in high school, another one was I wanted to set up an internet cafe. This was like, I'm very old, by the way. So this was before the year 2000. And my whole idea was like, you know, the internet is sick. An internet cafe obviously makes a lot of sense. You want to just put people, you know, together with a bunch of caffeine somewhere and like cigarettes and have awesome computers there. So I went out and actually raised like a bunch of money from my family and friends. And I was working with somebody who owned locally, like a chain of coffee shops. And she was actually high school friends with one of my uncles. So they kind of knew each other. And I came to her with like, my father is a lawyer and I like drafted a full agreement for this and like had the money and I'm like, I'm ready to go. And I approached her with the contract and she like freaked out. She's like, how, like, why is there a little kid trying to like make me sign a legal document to do like this internet cafe? I'm like, we talked about this. Like, this is where we got, you know, I literally went out and raised money for this. I'm ready to like buy a bunch of computers. You're going to be like the coffee person. Like here's the revenue sharing and everything. It was interesting. And she backed out. So I had to go like look for other places to do it, which were not as cool or interesting. And then I just kind of like threw out the idea because it sucked at that point. Cause there was not like another cool coffee shop that would have done my thing. I was like looking in weird, office strips and stuff like for retail spaces and, yeah, it was just, it ended up being stupid because that whole thing fell apart. But
how much did you end up raising for it?
Like 50 grand.
$50,000?
Yeah, before the year 2000, it was a lot. I mean, like I had.
So how old were you when you did this?
17.
Okay. How did you get convince people to give you $50,000 for an internet cafe?
Because it was the internet, and it was like the year 1998. You know, I mean, like, or 1999 even. Yeah, I think, I don't know. People were just at that point. Nobody was sold on like how big it was going to get. Mm-hmm. It was just kind of like, you know, AOL was still a thing, you know, and dial up, and I don't know. It was like a pretty shitty internet, but people were still like gaming was starting to come online barely. And you had like people making web pages and stuff. Like there was barely any, there was no like coding camps or anything like that. It was literally like people learning how to do HTML and Lisp and like C, and Java, which was pretty cringe. But like, if you knew what you were doing, you could, you know, rally groups of people around that kind of stuff. And it was interesting because I think a lot of it was just selling a future vision. And people had no clue what was coming, basically. So
what was the process like? Who did you go to with this idea other than your dad?
A bunch of family and friends. I mean, I was actually pitching like a real business model, though. I'm like, here's how much I'm spending on computers. Here's how much I'm charging for the time. Like, here's the revenue share with the coffee people. And they're like, cool. Okay. Sounds like a great business model. You're like, you're telling me that you can just get 10 computers and stick them like in the corner of a coffee shop and charge people like $20 an hour for it? I'm like, sure. Yeah, why not? Like people were more interested in like hanging out socially, you know, together and like drinking coffee and smoking and like being on a computer. So this is before smoking got banned everywhere too. So
it was still allowed in 2000.
I mean, where I was. Yeah.
Cleveland.
I mean, most people would like go outside and smoke still. I think it was kind of like on the businesses at that point. But I was trying to pitch that on some level, you know, like,
cause it was like cool.
Yeah, kind of. It was probably not a great idea in retrospect to like allow smoking at the same time, but yeah.
Interesting. Okay, so after this kind of, I guess, falls apart or you decide to discontinue it, you said that you got a few menial jobs or multiple menial jobs before you actually ended up going to college, mm-hmm. and I'd be curious to know what those were.
Yeah, I knew that I wasn't like mature enough to go to school. Uh-huh. I didn't want to just like waste a bunch of time. My one of my first thoughts actually was maybe I should go to business school. And then I like stopped for a second. I'm like, there's no reason to do that. Even it didn't make any sense. You know, it's like, if you're going to start a business, don't go to school to learn how to do a business, just make a business and do it. You're going to learn way more. And so I guess part of my hypothesis even then was I can just go work at a bunch of weird, I'm like thinking on the level of like internet cafe, you know?
Yeah.
So I did some landscaping. I delivered pizzas. I worked at my dad's law firm, like doing data entry, you know, like a little grunt basically.
So was part of the thinking behind this that you would basically like learn what these businesses what these businesses did and then just be able to like replicate it or something?
Not replicate them, but just like expose myself more to how these people kind of operate and think.
Okay.
And they're all different, you know, scales and levels and things like that. Yeah, the landscaping company was pretty interesting. The guy actually fired me ultimately because he was like, the guy who owned the landscaping company fired me directly. He was like,
nice.
You remind me too much of myself. Like, you gotta go. I was like, wow, thanks. It was pretty interesting. And then the pizza delivery place was fun. I did furniture delivery with a guy who basically, you know, he spun up a third party like delivery company that would attach itself to like smaller boutique luxury stores. And one of them was like a furniture store. And in the town that I'm from in Ohio, it's like a very, you know, wealthy, like waspy kind of town.
Mm-hmm.
And we delivered, you know, like $10,000 sofas like every day to people, you know, and like giant mega mansions and stuff like that. So it was really funny to ride around in our delivery van and, you know, deliver like crazy pieces of furniture to, I don't even know who these people were, but it was interesting to meet them, you know, because a lot of them were, you know, pretty high profile, like business people that lived in the area, or like doctors or lawyers or bankers and things like that. So it was interesting to get exposure to all of this stuff. And then, yeah.
Were you ever considering, when you were in this time period of like studying these other businesses, were you ever considering other options for like businesses that you might want to start like immediately afterwards?
I think it was always kind of in the back of my head. Part of me always kind of knew the power of like what was going to happen with technology and like the internet and everything. And I think growing up, you really had to pick something and go with it, obviously, right? Like I didn't ever feel enough draw to go start something like super intently in there. And the idea of like startups and like what we know now in this ecosystem did not exist then at all. I did a bunch of other weird random stuff. Like I built a web development company also, because I think like I started learning how to build websites in like 1996 or seven. Mm-hmm. And it was a thing, right? Like this is when websites like Tripod existed, which if you're not familiar with this, is like at the time, there was no real place to like build your own personal website. I mean, you could do all this manually, like go buy the domain and set it up and all this stuff. But I think Tripod was one of the first sites that let you build your own like homepage. So people and companies and everybody were like building sites, or they wanted to build sites. So I would do that for people. But actually like programming real software, was still a very, kind of like obscure thing.
Like niche.
Yeah. And I think the people that even, you know, built a lot of software back then, had no clue like how it was going to play out, really. And I don't know what has actually endured since that time
that
period, which is another really provoking thought, I think. But yeah, I don't know. I think it was just kind of like a swirling, you know, bunch of stuff going on in my head and trying to pick a direction. It wasn't necessarily clear that you could build startup companies as easily as we can today, now,
yeah.
Then.
Well, it just wasn't as easy.
It wasn't even a thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you'd hear stories, you know, like here and there about companies getting funded, and like the first dot-com bubble, that whole thing, the way that unfolded, like I was still too young to have been part of the first wave, I think, of companies that got built and pumped and, you know, exploded ultimately, like from that first wave. But yeah, it was super interesting.
Yeah. Did you ever learn to code and try to design anything at that point? Or
yeah.
No? You did?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, I was.
What language?
So C++ mostly. Okay. And other than web development, yeah, it was like C++ and Java.
Okay. And what'd you try to build?
Just even like really basic, like engines for video games and things like that. So like little physics engines and stuff. I mean, nothing that ever really
ended up being a real thing.
No.
Okay. Yeah. So then I think you like decided to go to college and study physics. What was the thinking behind that?
Oh, that's a whole other. Yeah. That's the whole. Yeah. Basically, during that time when I was thinking about working in different businesses and all that kind of stuff, I was also kind of on a spiritual quest. So I was raised kind of in like two different households, right? Mm-hmm. Like my family was half Jewish and half Christian, and we would celebrate both like every year. And I was really interested in figuring out like where I wanted like the direction of my spirituality to go. And so I actually spent a lot of time, you know, doing introspection and thinking mm-hmm. about what whatever meant to me. And I went beyond that too. And I looked into Buddhism and like other things. And ultimately, I decided that the most appropriate thing was actually trying to understand what the meaning of the universe was, basically, like physically. Yeah. Not replacing like a religion with that, but that was like a more overriding interest for me. Like I was just more curious about like the physical reality that we live in. So that's actually why I decided finally to go back to school and then start down that path of learning physics. And it was interesting as kind of like a, you know, an adult student going to college, because I started, I think, when I was 22 or 23.
Oh, so you actually had like a few years in between then.
It was a lot.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
5 years, I mean.
What did your family and stuff think about you when you were doing that?
Total fuck up, so yeah. I mean, I was not like, I was not scholarly during my high school years at all. I was a really, you know, I was a troublemaker.
Poor student? Or?
Yeah. I think I got in trouble way more.
Yeah.
And
what were the main reasons why you got in trouble?
Reasons?
Yeah. Like what did they not like?
Well, I mean, it was mostly just like my behavior. So there are a lot of stories there, but I think ultimately, I mean, that's a whole, it's a whole other conversation, but basically I'm pretty sure I was just kind of like bored, and acting out a lot, during that time was kind of like an expression of frustration. And I went through a lot of different like batteries and tests where they were trying to figure out like what was wrong with me basically, you know? So they like tried to measure my IQ to see if I'm, you know, like a total idiot or, like a psychopath basically.
what even suggested that that could be a possibility to them?
I don't know. Probably their expert opinion. Genuinely have no idea. But ultimately, you know, I think, the repetitive patterns in my behavior were kind of like, you know, act out, get in trouble for it. And then if I got like a detention, you know, I would never go to detention. And then that would stack up and they would give me like a Saturday school because I didn't go to my detentions, or I'd get too many detentions in a row. And then Saturday school was like a total bore because you have to sit in the library for like 8 hours, you know, from like 7 a.m. to 4 p.m. or something like that. all day long in one place. And you're just sitting there like doing work all day. On the weekend, right? Saturday school. So it's very punishing. And after I did a few Saturday schools, I was just like, I cannot do this, you know? So I stopped going to Saturday schools. Then they would give me like in-school suspensions because I didn't do that. So a lot of this was like in protest, obviously, but I was not a very good boy.
I love the line, I think it's maybe from Paul Graham, where he said, if you want to understand an entrepreneur, study the juvenile delinquent.
it didn't really get too much worse than that, but ultimately, you know, in school suspension was just like you were basically in like a jail cell all day long, in school somewhere, and you got like zeros for the day for everything, but you still had to work. And then at one point I actually like jumped out the window of my in school suspension and got out of school suspended. So it was, I took the progression all the way, to its ultimate form. But yeah, basically I had to figure things out. And then, yeah, like going to school, ultimately that's how I knew that I wasn't mature enough for any of that. Like even then, but going through a lot of this exploration and trying to figure out like what I wanted, I actually couldn't just like waltz back into a college, right? Like I had to go to community college and like take remedial courses and up my grades and everything and like actually try, because my grades were total shit. I don't think I got beyond like a 3.0 GPA in high school. I never took AP classes or anything like that. So yep. I was kind of like bottom of the barrel and I had to like crawl my way back out. So I spent a bunch of time before even I'd made the decision that I wanted to go to school and study physics, but like I needed to like work my way up to that. So I had to go to community college, do a bunch of math, right? And then apply. So, and I was only applying to like a state school, which was not really, you know, like the bar is not super high for that either. And I still wanted to make sure that I was kind of like, I would get into the program I wanted, you know, and be taken seriously. So I did that whole thing and ultimately like got in and then studied, you know, started studying physics. But then I realized that, like, to your point about like, what did my parents and family think of all this? I didn't get any support for any of this, right? And it's not because of I was just being like a total piece of shit and everybody hated me. It was just like, you got to figure your stuff out, you know?
They just didn't want to deal with it.
I don't know. It was just like, it's like trying to help an addict, you know, like you can only help them so much before you, like, they have to hit rock bottom kind of thing and then figure it out for themselves. So when I started school, finally, it was like a step in the right direction, but I also had to support myself. So I had to get like 2 full-time jobs, basically, to like pay my rent and my tuition, on top of like the loans that I was getting. So, I was working like 40 to 60 hours a week, plus taking like a full like course load. I had to moderate that. The first year I went in, I just went in blasting and I was like, that's too much. Like doing 20 plus hours of credits plus working 40 to 60 hours a week was a lot. And yeah, I had to tweak it a little bit. So it took me a lot longer to actually get through undergrad because in some semesters where I needed to focus way more on the classwork, I still had to work as much. So I was taking like half as many hours, you know, I had to always maintain like a certain level of them, but yeah, it took me like 5.5 years to get through undergrad basically.
Okay. Yeah. What happened? So I saw that in like 2007, you did some summer thing where you like went around to a bunch of different colleges like Princeton and stuff like that and like taught classes or something. What was that about?
That was just one of the jobs I had during undergrad.
Okay.
So one of these was writing software and the supporting like documentation for a simulation tool for like soft matter physics. And it was like particle simulations and stuff like that. So you'd have to, you know, it was like a federally funded project. And part of that was to...
Is that the NIST thing?
NSF.
NSF, okay.
Yeah. It was disseminated through, you know, a bunch of different programs. So we have to go around and like kind of peddle the platform that we built to different schools. And that was one of the things that I did, yeah.
Yeah. So how did you end up like, I don't know if I'm jumping around here, but how did you end up at SETI?
Oh yeah. So, right. So, I didn't really understand how somebody ultimately became like serious about going to graduate school for something like physics. And it took me until probably like the end of my, second year to understand how to put all that together and like package yourself really neatly. And I learned that I had to like do summer internships and, you know, write papers and probably be in like honors college and things like that. So, I got my grades up to the point where like I could join honors college, started doing like an undergrad, like honors thesis, applied to a bunch of, you know, summer internship programs. Like most of the other ones I wanted to do were, like astrophysics related. I was really interested in doing like high energy fusion research, basically. Like,
yeah, I saw that. Yeah.
That's ultimately what my passion still, like as a physicist, is always going to be energy, basically. Like if I could,
you know, what fascinates you about that?
I mean, it just accelerates everything about civilization. So more energy, better. And the best possible, you know, source for doing that, will still always be fusion, even if it is a pipe dream. Like we're going to figure it out. It's just, you know, always wanted to like go faster and do that. So that whole thing was a really interesting draw, but I wanted to get into programs that were like more astro or like heavy physics oriented. SETI ended up being, one of the only ones that like accepted me actually for that summer program. And it was still sweet though. I mean, I was like looking for aliens. So I got to, you know, move out to California. I lived on the NASA base, like right next to Google.
Was it the what is that place called?
Ames.
The Ames, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, so is this how it, so you also ended up like getting a job. You applied for one job, which was Google, and then you ended up actually getting it.
Yeah. That's not how I got it, but no.
Okay.
It's, I mean,
ironically, you worked in the building directly next to the Ames thing at Google as well, right?
Yeah, I mean, like the Google headquarters is right there.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's where I worked when I ultimately got that job. But yeah, it was super interesting because even then it was like a shell of this like former Air Force Base, Moffett Field. Mm-hmm. And NASA just had like its base there and we got to live in like the dorms or the barracks. And yeah, we would basically live there and then go back and forth to SETI's campus like every day, which was off that base. But yeah, like every day surrounded like by people riding their little Google bikes around and everything. I'm just like, what's going on over there? It was really fascinating.
Yeah. So at Google, you apply to Google, you actually get in. You had already moved out to California by the time that you applied or?
No. Okay. So yeah, that was like 3 years apart.
Oh.
That summer internship was like 2007 or eight. Yeah.
Mm.
And then I graduated in 2010.
Okay.
So part of like graduating and packaging yourself for grad school is like doing these internships and writing papers and theses and all that kind of stuff. And then you have to take like the regular GRE and then the physics GRE. There are, you know, specific like codified GREs for different subject fields. And the physics GRE classically is kind of like the hardest standardized test of all of them. And fight me if anybody else wants to, you know, complain about that, but because there are other ones for like bio and computer science and things like that, I think too now. But the physics one has always been like the king. So I spent like 6 months, you know, drilling and
writing
like,
on it.
Yeah. Because you have to be kind of like a monster to take those and like excel beyond what like people in China and India do. Cause all they do for their, they just like, they're trained on how to take those tests and we aren't, we're just like, you know, we learn the format of the test and like the questions and things like that. And we're supposed to use kind of like our ingenuity to solve the problems, right? If you're like really good at physics and math, whereas they are kind of like just grinding on like test taking just to get like a good score on the test. And yeah, so ultimately went through that whole thing, took the tests, had a bunch of panic attacks about like direction in life, in between waiting. And then like, yeah, one of the only job that I applied for was this like new program at Google where they were bringing on like new college graduates.
Yep.
It was kind of like a residency program. And the idea was to like expose you to how tech worked at that point, right? Like on the back end and like expose you to different teams and then ultimately like send you off and get you like a, you know, a job on a team of your liking basically.
Yep.
So yeah, like, at the point I graduated, I had applications out to PhD programs and then this job. And I actually did get accepted to some awesome PhD programs and then ended up turning them down and taking the Google job.
What were the panic attacks over? Like what else were you considering and decided against?
Well, this is the thing, like I wasn't, you know, like pacing around my room every day, like nervously thinking about this stuff. It's very like subconscious layer.
Yep.
And so I don't know, like I never in my forward conscious stress too much about that stuff. But it's like it is like a really weird, subconscious kind of existential thing where, you know, you're tying it to some kind of like fundamental need, right? Like I need shelter, I need money, I need food, I need water. And I think that is kind of how, you know, modern society kind of like bore that out through my psyche, basically. It's just like having a subconscious breakdown about like where, what direction I'm going to go in next, you know? Am I trying to become, you know, like a PhD in some like high energy physics field, or am I, you know, going to go work at Google and become like a corporate drone or something? They're all like, it's all very good, like champagne problems, but yeah, I think in some fundamental way, they kind of just like attack and eat away at these like needs that you don't really address or acknowledge even. And I think a lot of people like have nervous breakdowns about stuff like that. And they just, there's no easy way to tie it to what's happening, like in your forward conscious.
Yeah. Did you do anything else before you went and worked with Google? Like, did you start any companies? Did you work on any projects outside of college or no?
Only in college. Like okay. the only other thing that I did. So after SETI, you know, I got kind of into like radio astronomy, and I thought that like, our college should have a radio telescope. We had like an old optical telescope observatory, like off campus. And so part of me was like pretty jazzed about this whole thing. And I went around looking for old radio telescopes at like other colleges, and this group at like MIT and Wellesley had one and offered to give it to us. So I raised some more money for some students, and like we literally drove. I didn't actually drive out there, but sent these other guys to drive to Boston.
Delegated.
In a pickup truck with like a trailer to pick up the satellite and bring it back to Ohio. And then I think the sad thing was this, like we graduated, you know, and I don't think it ever actually like it got installed or set up or anything. So it, I think it just kind of sat in a pile and died. But it was rough. And like getting that job also derailed a lot of that stuff too, because I was just like, I got to go to California. Sorry, guys. And I bailed. So
yeah, it was just an opportunity that you had to take.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think when you first went to Google, I believe you worked on a team called RD Less Than C. What was that about?
So that was one of the first teams that I got exposure to through this residency program. Mm-hmm. But it was focused on renewable energy. And the idea was building a very cheap version of a heliostat,
yep.
Which is a solar farm where it's not actually collecting the energy in the panels. It's a bunch of mirrors, and they all redirect the light to a central tower. And that tower heats, you know, a Stirling engine to make energy, basically. It's pretty interesting. We have, you know, Ivanpah, which is out here, and there's a couple, I don't know if you've ever driven past those. They're wild. You probably can see them too when you're flying over into LAX sometimes. Mm. But yeah, I worked on that team for maybe a month before it got shut down, because this was during a transitionary period when Eric Schmidt was still the CEO. And then he stepped down, and Larry and Sergey
axe murdered it.
Well, they they took over the company, and then they deprioritized projects and, you know, units that were not computer science centric, and that one was not.
Yeah. What was so? And then after that got shut down, I believe you moved to the self-driving division. And that was like right next to Ames, I believe. Mm-hmm. And you were working underneath Anthony Lewandowski.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like?
It was interesting.
What's he like?
He was not my direct manager. He was like one above my direct manager. But yeah, no, it was cool. I mean, Sebastian Thrun had been the guy that was from like the Stanford DARPA team that won like the, you know, like the Baja challenges and things like that with their vehicles, and then ultimately came and started the chauffeur division at Google.
Yeah.
I think I got that right. I might not have got that right, but
it's all good.
Yeah. Sebastian brought on Anthony's team, and they came from Berkeley. And they had a company called 516 Systems where they developed like the sensor packages and stuff for self-driving, and he was kind of like the brains behind that operation and like the the actual brains of the car to learn how to do this stuff. And the very early versions of it were, you know, like chopping up a Prius and putting these sensor packages all over and trying to figure out how to get it to, you know, learn the world around itself and drive. And then, yeah, like we evolved when I was there from the Prius fleet to
Lexuses,
and these were like hybrid Lexus SUVs. Mm. And one of my jobs was like just doing a complete teardown of one and putting like mechanical transducers all over the frame and body of it to find out like where and how it vibrated, and you know, doing like a profile of this car to make sure that where we put sensor packages were like kind of safe, and they wouldn't just like rattle off the car basically. So there's a lot of you know, testing and stuff like that. But it's cool. It was a really interesting project to work on.
Yeah. Who were you looking up to at like this time? And did you have any transition? Because I know that like Phil really looked up to Tony Stark, you know, and Iron Man and stuff like that. So did you have anyone like that, or was it like Elon or?
No.
Not really?
I guess I never really did, no.
Huh.
I mean, scientists, maybe.
Who are those?
Like Feynman. Yeah. Feynman's always been kind of up there, I guess, for me. And von Neumann. And Claude Shannon in some way. Like, these were just people classically that I was more exposed to. No people really in, like, the business world, I don't think.
Yeah. Did you... So I think you like left Google and then you spent like 6 months at a company called Meetup in mm-hmm. New York. What was that about?
So when I left, I had decided that I actually wanted to go back to school, and mm-hmm. like I felt a pretty strong desire to gain mastery over something. I'd kind of realized that I just have become kind of like a master of none, you know? And I really enjoy getting my hands dirty and stuff. Like, I like actually building things. And that's something I kind of realized too about the original PhD program that I was thinking about. Like, I would have been writing software and doing simulations and writing grants and stuff like that, which is like not all bad, but the sheer magnitude of like how long that was gonna take was kind of nerve-wracking, I think, maybe. So doing like switching from physics into like an applied engineering field is kind of like a slap in the face to physics, because it's like you're downgrading yourself. If anything, it's usually like the other direction.
Yeah,
and you're like, wow, I want to go into physics or something. And you know, I had taught myself that I was capable enough to like learn these things, right? Like, I came from a place where in high school I was basically just like a total dumbass, and I didn't even know like how to do trig, you know, up to moving into like advanced math and physics that I, you know, pushed myself to learn. And it was great because a lot of it came pretty naturally ultimately when I let myself, you know, be open to it. So I was really happy with that. And then, yeah, the in-between time was kind of like, I'm definitely going to go back to school. So I reapplied to PhD programs again.
Yep.
Having like the Google experience behind me. And I decided to basically like move back to the East Coast. And I was looking for a job in between like the next year of the PhD program starting. So I took this job at Meetup, mm-hmm. to go get some more exposure to like a smaller startup company and in New York. So, I did that for a little bit. And then ultimately like got into a PhD program and moved back, for that.
Yeah. What was the transition? So you get into the PhD program and I think you're like 2 years in. Was it like 2 years in between working at Meetup and then starting Remesh?
Oh, yeah, something like that. I had basically like finished all of my coursework in the PhD. Mm. It's like the point in your graduate program where you switch over to doing like research, basically. So at that point, my research had been kind of locked in, and then, yeah, I was working on that and Remesh at the same time, basically for like a year.
Yeah. What was the first like few months of Remesh? Because I know that you initially started it as like a Twitter competitor, right? Mm-hmm. So what was the first few months of that, and why were you trying to build that company?
So my good friend was the one who like came up with the, you know, the framework for this whole thing. He had been thinking about the idea and like architecting it with other people, and his, and like he actually stayed at our school, where we went to undergrad at Kent State, and he went into the liquid crystal physics graduate program there. So he actually just went straight into a PhD there when I went out to Google. And then it was actually during the 2012 Palestine Israeli flare up, like a really big one then. And in his grad program, there were like Palestinians and Israelis, and everybody's just like, this is the stupidest shit. Like, you know, we can exist together and like, we're chill. It's kind of like the government is, you know, they are trying to fight each other. And the
great
whole
chaos.
Yeah. And the whole idea was kind of like, can we disaggregate like the voice of the people from the government somehow? And the idea was like, we want to build a platform that can be representative of a massive group of people, and use technology to do that, and be able to like be kind of like decentralized and unified with the voice that we were giving to whatever group of people. So it was actually a really powerful underlying like
idea,
yeah,
or premise.
I think so. Building the actual technology was way harder, because ultimately what we were trying to do is create like a real-time live, you know, vehicle for a conversation where one side of that conversation could be like a million people on one side of a conversation, and the other side could be another group of a million people, or just like one person. You know, one of our fantasies was always like, can we get like a million Americans to talk to the president at once? You can't do that on Twitter. Sorry, Elon. Or, you know, like you can do it in small doses, basically, right? Like a focus group. I don't know if you're familiar with that. This is all like market research stuff, but yeah. Being able to create meaningful signal out of a massive number of people is really, really hard. So we actually, you know, ultimately built that platform. And for us, being able to like aggregate a giant group of people in real time, like in a conversational format that made sense. Like you're literally just talking back and forth to a group of people. That was kind of like the driving motivator behind that.
What was the, so I believe, like you said, you were trying to get, you know, create a platform where the president could talk with a million of, you know, his constituents. You said that you got to the White House, and then you got turned down because you weren't the size of Google, so they didn't want to use you. Tell me about this.
Yeah, I basically just like hacked my way into the White House. So
okay, how'd you do that?
Just like finding the right
person,
like people and contact information that was publicly available, and then just like, yeah, harassing them. I ended up finding, I mean, it's public knowledge, but like I got the phone number to like the switchboard at the White House, and I would like call in there and like try to find the right people after doing some research on like who I needed to talk to. I got like ping ponged around a bunch of times, but ultimately like did find the right people, and they were like, yeah, you're like this tiny startup and you're not Twitter, right? Like, we're not really sure like how to do something like this. Maybe you should try it with like a local politician or something first and like, you know, grow up a little bit. I'm like, okay, cool. So yeah, it's that same unfortunate reality that you kind of like run into the wall of, you know, just not being proven enough for somebody's tolerable acceptance level. So yeah,
yeah. What was the transition? So after you got like turned down effectively by the White House, how long did it take for you guys decide to pivot, and then what was the thinking behind pivoting?
Well, it was mostly like, you know, we can turn our wheels for a while on trying to be like a social platform. And this was at a time when they were, social platforms in general were kind of going in and out of favor. Mm-hmm. Like the whole 2013 through 2016 era. And a lot of that, I think ultimately we were just deciding that we wanted to push the business along. And so we knew that it was really good for market research in general. Like, we ended up just, yeah, going through a TechStars program in New York, and we got enough connections and seed money at that point to pivot into market research. I mean, we had already pivoted into it at that point, but we did our first million in revenue like really quickly in market research, basically. Okay. So it was, that's what we raised our first round off of, was like that momentum.
What was the TechStars experience like?
It was actually pretty interesting. I mean, they drive a really interesting model where they try to expose you to, you know, they have like a whole thing. I don't know if they still do this, but when we went through, there were like, there was a mentor track where you get matched up with awesome people in your field, and they become kind of like your mentors. You don't have to give them equity or anything. They're there to just kind of like
help you out,
whip you into shape. There were like biz dev, there was like a whole biz dev track where like for a whole week, you got intros to pretty much any company you wanted. And you could, you know, push those relationships forward. And then there was like an investor track where you just got peppered like 20 meetings a day with investors, basically. So they ran a really interesting program where you kind of like go through all those tracks. And then in the meantime, you're building your company and trying to work your way up. And yeah, ultimately, the one that we were in was a fintech accelerator that was paired with like Barclays Bank. And we had nothing to do with fintech. But the people at TechStars like loved us and like what we were building. And they were just like, sweet, this is awesome.
We'll just have you in the program as well.
Yeah. So it was pretty cool. And that was like a huge leap of faith for them to like bring us into the program. And that first class of ours actually produced, I think, a couple unicorns actually. It was a really interesting like first vintage of companies.
You said that you also did another accelerator, I believe, in Cleveland.
Yeah, before all that.
What was that?
Yeah, it was great. So this was it was a local accelerator that was done by it was called Flash Starts, and the idea behind it was you know, there was no local accelerator in Cleveland, right? It's Cleveland. And we were trying to like build up the scene there. And part of that was to get, you know, awesome companies in. And the guy that started it was also a former founder, and he had sold books.com to Amazon, actually.
Really?
yeah, you should talk to him. you know, he was really great. And he was like a huge champion of like the ecosystem and everything for a long time. And he had a great partner that actually came from like Google, YouTube lineage, and both of them combined were actually like a really great launch pad for new companies. So we went through that for a summer. And yeah, that was like our, you know, our first little baby local accelerator program. and yeah, I think that was kind of like the extent of it though. Just like a summer program.
Yeah.
A little blip.
But it was good.
It was good. It was good. Yeah.
Interesting. Okay. What was, so from going to pivoting, getting to a million, raising your first little bit of capital, what was the transition between raising that capital and then doing the Series A in which you decided to like leave? How did that happen?
I mean, it was just like the typical grind, you know, like building up the team and customer base and the product.
Do you have any interesting stories from that period?
Probably.
And are publicly shareable? Asterisk.
I mean, it's I don't know. A lot of it is the very prototypical like grind track, right? Like every day you're just coming in and like hammering on the product. You're trying to get customers, you know, keeping conversations alive with investors. It's the same juggling act of any founder, I think.
What was the most interesting story that you have of like getting a customer?
I mean, ultimately, one of our best anchor customers ended up being Procter & Gamble, you know, some
really?
Like giant
yeah.
conglomerate also in Ohio. we ended up getting them because Techstars, the thing that they put together during their biz dev day, was renting out the entire Cincinnati Reds stadium in Cincinnati and like bringing all the companies there. And I ended up during like the opening remarks of the event, you know, like all, we're all like sitting in the seats of the stadium and like they go out in the field and, you know, do their thing. I sniped the like an exec at Procter & Gamble. He was the CMO and I sat right next to him and like, you know, pitched him in like 15 seconds. And he was like, all right, we got to have a call. Like, I'm going to get my people to set up like a meeting. And that just kind of like snowballed into a bunch of meetings and we like full pitched them and they ended up, you know, coming on board and becoming like one of our biggest customers. That relationship grew over time, but it was that one little snipe, you know,
that
in the
one
stadium.
Little interaction. Yeah. Did you make a conscious decision? Like, did you know that they were that who they were?
Yeah.
And so you made a conscious decision to sit right next to them.
Yeah.
How did you actually figure out where they were sitting and stuff like that?
I mean, everybody had like name tags and stuff, you know? So I kind of just like
eyeing them.
Oh yeah.
Oh, this is hilarious. See, it's kind of funny because some of these stories, like I think if people, I find them fascinating. You know, these things are fascinating to me. So I just assume that other people will like them too. Okay. So when you did your Series A, you kind of decided to like, slowly phase yourself out, I believe. How did that happen? What was that?
Yeah, so this is
a few years later.
Yeah, the story behind this is, well, I'll give you one version of it.
Okay.
But basically, this was all pre-COVID.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea of like remote working was not super acceptable. And I've always been, I don't have like a very strong position on either side of this. I'm not a zealot about like everybody has to be here with me like all the time. I don't care about like remote work either. My thinking about this is basically like you need the best people to get the job done. So do that. If some of them are in person, great. Like, I personally, one place where I draw the line is like, I'm never gonna let anybody be 100% remote. And I never was either. And so during this time I was like jet commuting back and forth to New York every week, basically for like almost a year. Like I would fly into New York at like 5 a.m. on Monday morning. We had like a corporate apartment in Brooklyn. And yeah, I would get to the office and stay there all week, work with the rest of the team, and then I'd fly back to my home in Cleveland on Friday afternoon. So I did that for a long time. And then ultimately when we were like getting up to the Series A, it was kind of like, you know, I was the CTO and we were trying to figure out like what direction to move in as we grew and everything like that. And ultimately, there was a strong desire for, you know, from the board and everybody else to like make everybody move to New York. And I basically put my foot down. I was just like, no. And part of it was also like I was trying to remove myself from being kind of like an IC. Like, you know, I was never like the lead programmer on any of our stuff or anything like that. But I wanted to actually like build up an engineering team. And that's where I thought most of my strength would ultimately be. And we didn't see eye to eye on that. So I basically was just like, yeah, I want to focus on building an engineering team to actually build the product. And I want to be in charge of that, not like sitting around coding every day. And I'm also not moving to New York. So I kind of like put my foot down and I thought that that was like enough of a contribution, right?
Yeah.
And we just, yeah, like, I think my co-founders were like kind of okay with it, but like the
you know, board of directors and those guys
and the new investors and things like that were not on the same level, basically. So I think ultimately that's kind of where we just like, yeah, we had a discontinuity and I, you know, we had to decide to move apart at that point. Yeah.
When when you decided to kind of like move on, I believe, I don't know if you were like lost or something, or were you somewhat lost or no?
I mean, it was a pretty like heat of the moment kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't lost. I actually felt like I didn't feel lost. I feel like I had lost something. So it was like I just lost my like baby or something, you know? It was a really hard decision for sure.
Yeah. You decided to, I believe, go into like, I don't know if it was a hobby or like to try and spin up this business creating D&D characters and like plastic figurines and then Warhammer figurines. What was that about?
Well, this, yeah, I mean, I, so when I left, I ended up having a little bit of like buffer mm-hmm. to figure out some stuff and, you know, what I wanted to do next. I had no intention of starting another venture company right away, like at all. And I was just like, yeah, just dicking around. And one of my passion projects I was working on was, because I'm a huge dork, is like playing, yeah, D&D and Warhammer and stuff like that. There's only like a handful of companies that actually make these little figurines, and it's a crazy hobby thing. Yeah. People spend a ton of money on these things. They like paint them and collect them and show them off. I've seen personally like individual collections that are worth $500,000 of these like things.
Wow.
People are insane about this. And I thought it'd be a cool idea to just, you know, try to figure out a way to do like quick turn. It was basically like a box subscription for nerds. Like I want to make, I don't want to make figurines that like represent your own character, but just like weird other stuff that's out there. Like monsters and scenery objects and things like that. Like nobody really did that. Mm-hmm. And the only legacy companies that were out there are just like these really old, you know, companies. I could see like how they did their process. It was pretty interesting. And I was like, yeah, maybe you can try to make a new company like this. So I spun up like a landing page and posted in a bunch of places, you know, like I'm going to do this, and got a bunch of people like all excited about it and got the, you know, the pre-demand and buy-in and everything. And then I went out to go like design and manufacture a first run of these things. And yeah, it turned into just like a total nightmare.
And talk about why that was a nightmare, because I've learned a little bit about it, but.
Yeah, it's just, making any physical product is really challenging, right? Mm-hmm. Like you have to design it somewhere with a product designer, and then that ultimately has to go to test like the manufacturability of that design. Depending on what method you're going to use. So for these, the easiest way to produce a lot of them was to make a mold for them. And, you know, there's a bunch of different ways that you can make molds for this type of plastic, but injection molds are kind of, you know, the like goated version of this. Like you build one and it will produce like millions of parts. Mm-hmm. My thinking around this is like, I don't want the same static product to be sold forever. Like I want to do many different iterations of different things. And obviously like 3D printing should be the better solution for that. But even at that point when I tried this, it was still just like kind of a joke. I mean, mm-hmm. not at that level of quality that I wanted, or the volume. So you're always kind of thinking about like price, volume, and quality,
mm-hmm.
In terms of like what you're trying to produce. And none of these methods really allowed me to do this because like making a mold, I found out, was actually insanely expensive. And a lot of the people I knew that were actually in hardware all told me to just go on like Alibaba.
Yeah. You said it would take like 4 months or something. You just hand them a bunch of money and then like a crate shows up with all your pieces or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, and they make you order like minimum amounts of stuff, right?
And like 100,000 or something.
50. Yeah.
50.
And they tell you that they're going to like take over the whole thing, and like you just give them designs basically and they'll figure out the rest. So it sounds really great until you get to the part where it's like, you know, you have to do proofs of the designs, and then they might tell you that like something is not actually moldable for whatever reason, or you build the mold and start getting samples of the parts back and they're bad or like not what you want. And then you have to like redo the mold and pay for that whole thing. It's just crazy. Like the whole thing was nuts to me. And yeah, so I ultimately figured for like this application that I wanted, which was like kind of quick turn, a lot of high mix in terms of like what I wanted to make and the price point that I was trying to aim at was still
like just not feasible.
A no-go.
Yeah. So how did you decide to start Atomic and what was the first like month or two like?
Yeah, the thing I learned about the whole process was just doing the tooling for something like this, right? Tooling is just another word for I need a mold to make this thing. So any type of manufacturing of any component, right? Like it has to either be machined directly or stamped or forged or cast or molded inside of a, you know, another thing.
Yep.
And that trade is called tool and die making, right? So like to make manufacturing tools is this super involved process that I'm talking about, which is like study the feasibility, try to figure out like, you know, the manufacturable nature of it. Then you have to like design and simulate the tool. Then you have to machine the tool, make it, and then you have to test it before your parts are coming out how you want them to. And I figured if I had to go through all that just to make some stupid toys, like I can't even imagine how bad this is for global scale companies, right? Like obviously they're going to have their process like dialed in and they're going to have suppliers that they trust and work with. But, you know, yeah, I ended up spending like a year interviewing all kinds of people. Like I would, you know, I would just try to figure out like how their book of business works, like how they thought about the industry on like a level that's very kind of macro. I would just impersonate being like a business school student. I'm like, hey, I'm doing a report on tool and die makers in the US. You know, like tell me all your secrets basically. And it was crazy because like people would just drop everything. You know, they would tell me all kinds of crazy stuff. And I learned a lot about the trade and how the industry worked and everything. And yeah, I mean, like one of the classic problems has just always been technology and manufacturing don't play well together. Like they're oil and water. Hmm. They have been for a very long time. And I just, to me, it became a very clear like opportunity. And I knew it was going to be something that was like a monumental task and take a very long time to do, but ultimately would be, you know, kind of like a fundamental layer to society in terms of like how AWS transformed technology, right? Like mm-hmm. being able to spin up something on AWS today. Or
extremely cheaply.
Yeah, it's super cheap. It's super easy. All the infrastructure is in place. I love that analogy to the physical world. Like we don't have that.
Are you trying to create the like AWS for physical plastic products?
Well, for all of manufacturing. Yeah. Okay. I mean like the idea is that you need some type of AWS, right? That like makes it that easy so that, yeah, I can make my stupid toys or you can make F-35 parts, right? For your jets or we can make submarines. Like I am still pretty convinced that like the thing that, you know, our adversaries should fear are not, I mean, like, of course, it's like the aircraft carriers and the bombs and everything like that. But it'd be more interesting if they actually feared our ability to make those things at will, right? And people will say like, yeah, but you can't just have factories and like, you know, raw materials and everything just sitting around waiting to make aircraft carriers, right? Like, that's fine. But it's very apparent that with a weak industrial base, right, like you're just a sitting target. And a lot of the capability that we are demanding from the free market right now is just not at the level of what it needs to be. AKA like drones and artillery and all these other things, right? Like, don't get me started.
So after that year, was this right around like, I know that you did Y Combinator in 2021. When did you like bring on your co-founder and then what was the process of going through YC?
Yeah. I brought them both on during YC, basically. So, like, I got into YC first by mm-hmm. myself and then was kind of like, all right, everybody, like, we got to get this thing moving. So I brought one of my buddies on first, and then ended up bringing my second co-founder on during YC as well, or like at the end.
Yeah,
basically. And yeah, like combined between the three of us, we had kind of like hit all the different buckets of like technology, the finance world, and the manufacturing world. And going through YC was interesting as a second time founder, because I got to compare it directly to like my my first experience in like going through Techstars and raising money with Remesh and everything. And I used it almost as kind of like a filtration system, where I was getting like a new lens on the landscape and like what it was like to build a new technology company in 2021 versus like
2012.
Yeah. Through 2018 or whatever, when I was working on Remesh. And it was like fascinating in terms of how different it was.
What were the differences?
Well, the most immediate thing was just like how people were raising money in it, like what prices and everything. It was definitely something was off. And it wasn't like I'm wandering around like an old geriatric man, like, oh, everybody's just like paying more money for everything now. It's like seriously like some fundamental issue of what, you know, what is going on here. This is not right. And yeah, it was really interesting, because the true kind of like ZERP thing was in full effect.
Yeah. What was the best thing about YC?
I think the most interesting thing or best thing about YC is just, it was, so our batch was remote. We were like the second remote batch. And I think you could still, I mean, a lot of the same like energy was still there and present. I mean, I never experienced the in-person one. But it definitely felt that way. So we kept a lot of the same like accountability mechanisms and everything going like multiple times a week. And the pressure was like definitely...
It was on.
It was on for sure. If you didn't show up to like your next group meeting with progress, it was very shameful. So in that way, it was definitely still like a very driven process, I think. But the best things about it were probably just getting to know everybody around us. Like our batch had some crazy like hard tech companies in it.
Who specifically?
I mean, we had Stokespace in ours. We had I'm gonna blank on all these names because Moxion. So like Stoke, Moxion, Topher's company is like a satellite imagery company. They're, like all these companies are doing amazing right now. It was fascinating to see the kind of like welcoming and adoption of hard tech companies in something like YC, where they're so traditionally like a machine for SaaS companies, right? And like selling internally to like your batch and other YC companies and things like that.
Yep.
Like, yeah, well, you want to buy a rocket. So it was really, really fascinating. And I kind of loved the idea that they were, you know, accepting of the hard tech companies. I still really want to see them focusing a lot more on them. And I love that, like, even in the new batch, their new request for startups is like stuff in the physical world. Reshoring US manufacturing is a request for a startup at Y Combinator. Like, it's incredible. I love that kind of like the Overton window got shifted in that direction. So I think that was probably my favorite thing about it. And then, yeah, like all the craziness around like demo day and getting exposed to these awesome partners that had built, you know, like most of the partners at YC are very accomplished, right? Like it's, you can learn a lot from them. So it was really pretty amazing. Yeah.
I would be curious. So I have like two more questions. First is, you've worked with multiple co-founders on multiple different startups. And so what learnings or lessons do you have from those experiences on how to find the right co-founder and work with them successfully?
Yeah, this is kind of like a age old question, and it's not something that has a direct one size fits all answer, I don't think. I I would say my approach, yeah, I don't know. It's tough because ultimately you're getting married, right, to like other people, and you have to work pretty intimately with them. So, the expectations, are something that are very strange to deal with ultimately, because you have no clue how things are going to unfold. And you don't know, like, you need to make sure that, like, when something bad happens, you have a good mechanism to deal with that. Like, conflict resolution is way more important than actually being successful ultimately, because if you can't deal with that, that's when this kind of stuff
things
breaks
just
down.
Start breaking.
Yeah. And the statistic of, like, you know, I don't, what is it?
50% like, of marriages in divorce.
Not even that, but like, and then startups, like, of the 90% of startups that fail, like 75% of those are because of founder
breakups.
Yeah. Issues and things like that. And I think that's, indicative of, you know, the kind of culture and everything that we build. And there's a big filter there. Like, you jump into something with a bunch of people, it's awesome and it's exciting, but when the rubber meets the road and you have to make really hard decisions, or somebody's like dragging ass, or you get really successful and you have no idea how to like divide up that success, like, those things are all things that will shatter that kind of relationship pretty quickly.
So how did you actually go about deciding who you wanted to bring on as a co-founder?
I just kind of like put my expectations out pretty openly. And then the one friend of mine who I brought on, I'd known him for like, you know, 15 years basically. And we'd been wanting to work on something for a while, and talking about the like reindustrialization, reshoring thing was something that, you know, we'd been thinking for
excited.
A while. Yeah. And the other part of it was, during my year of research, I looked for companies that were innovating on tool and die making, like, in any way, shape, or form. And there are not a lot of them. but one of them was, you know, this shop up in Michigan, pretty close to where I'm from in Cleveland. And, you know, decided to go up there and like meet with them.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it was really interesting. Like, good vibes and everything like that. And ultimately, I had actually no idea or intention of ultimately like bringing my other co-founder on from that company. But I was like, when I came out of that meeting, I was like, yeah, these guys are awesome. You know, like, I would want to go get a beer with them, or like, you know, hang out with them. I wasn't making a decision fully on that at all, but ultimately when we were going through IC, I ended up getting, you know, in touch with him and talking to him about like kind of the progress and everything. And he was like, okay, it's really cool. And then I got a phone call from him one day where he was kind of like, you know, I'm thinking about leaving my company, and, you know, what does that potentially, where does that leave us? And I was like, oh.
Actually.
So, I mean, it was kind of like a no-brainer at that point, but we like talked about it and it made a ton of sense. And everybody was like super jazzed about it. So that's, I mean, it was a process that like got baked over a year's worth of time of like interactions and things like that. So
these were people that you knew that you really wanted to work with.
Yeah. And ultimately, I don't know if I would ever make a snap decision to just like become co-founders of somebody in less than like a month's time. That would be really hard for me. So maybe the one size fits all solution is actually spending more time on thinking about who you're going to ultimately work with if you work with co-founders.
Over a number of conversations and things
at
like
least,
that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So final question, what's the hardest thing you've overcome?
It's a good question. It's definitely something like personal in nature. And I don't really, I'm not going to put it out there, but I will say that it's something that I experienced before I was 18. And it was like an incredibly traumatic event for everybody involved, and something that, like, you know, I have to live with for the entire rest of my life. But Yeah. It's something that also I don't think I'll ever actually like get over necessarily, but
just a part of you.
It's part of me for sure. And it's something that like changed me forever. And to be 100% fair, that might have been the thing that ultimately kicked off my like exploration of spirituality, right? And like what made me become serious about all of this. And it's like a key part of this whole story, but it's something that I, you know, keep pretty close to myself.
That's
but
fine.
It's still of that magnitude, basically. And yeah, I mean, I definitely feel for other people that go through this kind of, you know, personal journey. But those kinds of transformational experiences are things that like, you know, will mold and sculpt you for the rest of time, basically. And yeah, without giving too much away, it was enough.
It was just really hard.
Yeah.
Okay. Aaron, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Awesome.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.